Hello, I'm Kerry Lonergan. Welcome to the Weekly Grill. It's brought to you by Beef Central and Elanco Animal Health. Our guest today on the grill is a doctor with a difference. He's not only eminently qualified, he's an orthopedic surgeon, but he is an active campaigner on the benefits of red meat. Dr. Gary Fetke, welcome to the grill on Beef Central.
Good morning, Kerry. Nice to be here.
Well, what did you have for breakfast? Did you have red meat for breakfast?
Look, I did actually. Everyone asked me about that, you know, because I don't have cereal anymore. Normally have meat. Last night's meat and veg made up into an omelette. And I've been making up one of the local butchers is making up a super mince for me. So I make these meatballs, or I've had these meatballs made up with fatty mince and lamb heart and lamb liver. So I call them super meatballs or keto meatballs. And I've got to admit, they're the most, they're nutritious, but they're the most filling meatballs that you can ever have.
I can just
truly eating nose to tail.
I can just imagine all the beef producers around Australia nodding their heads in agreement.
Well, and, you know, throw in an egg. They're just all animal-based food this morning, and that'll keep me going all day.
Wonderful stuff. Now, when you cook a steak, I assume you cook a steak on the barbecue sometime?
Yes, we do have barbecues in Tasmania, despite the weather.
And what's your preferred level of cooking?
Medium rare, towards medium. As an orthopaedic surgeon, if it's too rare, it reminds me of my day job.
Do you have control of the barbecue?
All surgeons have control of their environment.
Yes, I've heard that as well. But tell me, when did you gain this rather substantial support for red meat?
I'll come back one step and say, why are we calling it red meat? Why don't we just call it meat?
Okay, we'll call it meat.
And in the last year, in the middle of the Black Lives Matter thing, I actually came up with the hashtag Red Meat Matters. And Belinda said, that's my wife, she said, don't go there. And I said, well, actually, this is really, really important. Why are we discriminating against meat based on its colour? And when you actually start realising there's a whole culture and educational issue, and it's been going back for over 100 years, about the demonisation of red meat. And we've actually all fallen for that. The industry's fallen for that. They're calling themselves red meat. And it's actually meat. And there's not a lot of biochemical difference between red meat, white meat, you know, chicken, beef, lamb, pork. They're all, even fish, they've all got very similar biochemical profiles for our health. So, you know, I actually talk about meat matters rather than just red meat matters. To come back as to how I became interested and why I'm supporting the whole meat topic is that I'm an orthopaedic surgeon. I, for many, many years, 20, 25 years, was looking after most of the diabetic foot complications in northern Tasmania. And so when every week when I'm trimming off a bit of foot or trimming off a lower limb, you know, amputations, cleaning up all this necrotic flesh, and I know that sounds horrible, but that was what I used to do every Friday in the public system. I started realising that we can't just keep band-aiding sick care. We've actually got to look at finding the cause of it. And the root cause of diabetes is our diet. And when you start going into it, the excessive amount of sugar and refined carbohydrates means that we have got an obesity epidemic, we've got a diabetes epidemic, and we've got a health issue. And everything that's flowed on from that, we've got a health tsunami upon us, which has literally come on as a result of our dietary intake in the last 100 years, but particularly the last 50. So when you actually realise that refined carbohydrates and sugars and the polyunsaturated oils, the seed oils, are dangerous and harmful, then you've got to eat something. And so when you actually realise that you can take away the cereals and the refined carbs, then you've actually got to come back to the animal-based product. And that our diet, which should be our ideal diet, and certainly our evolutionary diet, was based around animal-based food and red meat. So that's how I've come into this space, A, because I needed to find something to eat which wasn't, following the food pyramid. And that means we've got to be, move back towards it. And it's actually got enormous health benefits, and the science is there to support it.
Is there evidence that people got diabetes at the level we do these days? Is there evidence that it occurred several hundred years ago?
The first documented cases of diabetes are from Egyptian times. If you go to the pharaohs, first descriptions were there. But they, interestingly, that whole Egyptian delta, around the Nile, they became grain-based, and they had a lot of that. And the rich or the elite there worshipped honey, and so in some of those archaeological findings, they still find honey. So the first descriptions of diabetes are actually, you know, ancient. And even in the late 19th century, it was still a rare condition, generally associated with the elite. And it was the issue that now that we have probably two-thirds of the population either diabetes or pre-diabetes, and there are ways of testing that. This is a new phenomenon. And that's and it's related to our current dietary intake. It's not a lack of exercise. It's what we put in our mouths is the major problem.
I'll talk about diet later on. Can I ask, did you have actually made the claim that there's never been a proper scientific analysis of meat where the result has been not damning? I mean, do you claim that we haven't researched this well enough and there are no peer-reviewed papers on meat?
There's no controlled study, okay, where you control for all of this, that's actually shown that meat's harmful. And the talk I gave at Beef 2021 is that when you start making assumptions based on association data, this is associated with that, then you've got to be very, very definite in your endpoint. So the concept that smoking causes lung cancer is well established now, and that's association data. They've never done a controlled trial to prove that smoking causes lung cancer. It's all done on, you know, statistical analysis. So the association data is that if you smoke, then it carries with it a 1,600 to 2,000% increase risk of you developing lung cancer. Not everyone who gets lung cancer, however, is a smoker. So look at that figure, 2,000% increased risk of getting lung cancer if you smoke. Now, the worst studies that are associated with meat consumption and outcome, cancer, are sort of talking about 14, 12, 14, 16, 18% max. That's way off 2,000%. And there's a higher risk, as I pointed out in that talk, that you've got a much higher risk of developing bowel cancer. If you're male, it's a 37% increased risk. And if you're a smoker, it's 51% increased. But we don't hear about smoking causes bowel cancer. We don't hear about males being the cause of bowel cancer. We all hear is that red meat is the cause of it. And when you actually delve into those studies, we talked about 12, 14, 16, 18%. If you look at the headline, that's what they say. But if you go into the actual data and delve down into it, it's all inconclusive. However, the press latch on upon it. The industry then fall for it because they start believing that maybe there is a problem. But more importantly, the public are starting to believe in it because of the propaganda. And so a lot of our work, my work and my wife's work, has been around working out where this propaganda comes from and where the demonisation of red meat comes from, because it's got nothing to do with science. You know, Mark Twain once quoted, you know, it's easier to fool the people than convince them they've been fooled. But this tomfoolery has been going on for 100 years.
I can't count the number of anti-meat articles I've read, Gary, heard or watched. So you must have known when you took us on that you were swimming against the tide, so to speak.
However, we're basing it on science. You know, my talks and are based on biochemistry, which is incontrovertible, and it's based on history, which is written down and acknowledged all the way along. It's not based on opinion. It's not based on association. It's literally, here are the facts. This is what happens. Nutrition inside the cell is science. Outside of the cell, it's non-science. It's politics. It's money. It's, you know, unfortunately, an enormous influence of religion. And that religious ideology is, you know, behind the origins of veganism, vegetarianism. It's actually not science. It's a fascinating thing because I started going down this nutrition pathway because of my patients' health and well-being. And then everything I touched literally was a house of cards. You know, the breakfast is the most important meal of day, just made up by the breakfast cereal industry in the late 1800s. The concept of, you know, the brain is dependent on sugar, on carbohydrate, complete myth. The biochemistry can't be lied, can't be made up. And when I started going back to that, I realised everything, you know, unfortunately, in nutrition science is literally made up. And once people believe it, you know, and you believe your teachers, call that generational education. If your textbooks say that, then you'd believe it. However, the textbooks in nutrition were written by the breakfast cereal industry starting in 1917.
I'll get onto that later on, Gary. But when you started this pro-meat campaign, if I can call it that, when you started that, what was the reaction, first of all, from your fellow medicos and through the broader profession?
Well, I started talking about the perils of sugar 10, 12 years ago. And most people looked at me with disbelief, thinking I've lost the plot, including my co-workers, my university And I look at how far that topic's gone. Now, most people realise that too much sugar is dangerous. We've got the WA health system, government now creating a ban on sugar-sweetened beverages in hospitals. I took that to the Tasmanian government 12 years ago, and yet now that's becoming public policy. Now, at the time, I was seen as a complete heretic. But now we're talking about nutrition. Now, public health policy 101 now is that sugar is harmful. The same thing's gone with the meat. It probably worked out that I'm a fairly stubborn character. And if it's based on science and not based on myth, and it's going to improve my patient health outcomes, then I'm not going to stop. And if it means upsetting a few doctors along the way because that's what their beliefs are, because that's the way they were educated, then so be it. But every week there are more and more doctors getting on board with this. The health professional, the health system can't ignore the fact that we can turn around diabetes. We can reverse it, can be put into remission. We can treat obesity by not following the food pyramid.
Let's talk about diets and eating habits. The most common meal today, what I would suggest, would be plenty of carbohydrates, vegetables, occasionally red meat is recommended. What's wrong with a meal like that?
Well, we didn't evolve with carbohydrates in our diet to the extent they're being promoted. If you think about carbohydrates on the whole and how they're available in nature, then they're available in seasonal fruit, a little bit in meat, in the glycogen portion of meat. Vegetables on the whole weren't available in the amounts that are available nowadays when you look at it over the last 2 million years. So we got to the top of the food chain without carbohydrates. There is not a single biochemical pathway in the body that requires carbohydrate to be ingested. The brain is not dependent on glucose. The small amount we need for a few cells in the body, the red cells in particular, can be generated by the liver. But there are essential proteins and there are essential healthy fats which we need to eat to exist. So our diet evolved over 2 million years without carbohydrate in it. And it was only seasonally available. And as I sometimes say, God wasn't stupid enough to make our body dependent on something which was seasonally available. We've got a hybrid engine in there which actually runs probably more efficiently on healthy proteins and healthy fats, which are available all year round from animal-based production. So this whole concept of we must have 50% of our diet as carbohydrate is literally just made up out of thin air in the last 100 years, completely and utterly supported by the processed food industry, who were writing the textbook, as I say, starting back in 1917.
Heavens, we'll discuss that later too. So what carbs, according to your analysis, what carbohydrates should we avoid?
Particularly the ultra-processed ones. So if it comes in a cardboard box and a plastic bag and it's got a label on it, that's my mantra, you don't need to eat it. Realistically, I mean, I have a diet lifestyle where I'm probably, and I don't measure it specifically, but it's less than probably 20 grams of carbohydrate per day. I do eat a bit of seasonal fruit. There is a bit of carbohydrate in the cheeses I eat, but I'm not having, I'm not vegetable free, but the carbs I'm getting are in cauliflower, broccoli, carrots, some above ground vegetables. So it's very, very low. And, I've been living this way for 10 years. It's improved my health dramatically. And my brain's still functioning, even though some people may argue that what comes out of it.
Gary, like all good doctors, you're into preventative medicine, as you've mentioned. How much meat should an adult consume each day?
I don't think there's an upper limit. I know it's touted, and literature says you should be avoiding X, I mean, the Eat Lancet report that came out last year was trying to drive us down to less than 8 grams a day. I think on average, if we're looking at it, we should be eating our protein to our requirements. So children and the elderly, the sick and those exercising a lot need more protein on average per kilo than, let's say, people between 30 and 50. So that rough figure is about a gram per kilo per day. That's a protein. How you get that protein, I think, is actually easier to get from animal-based product. It doesn't have to be meat. It doesn't have to be red meat. But it can also include eggs and cheese and some in nuts. The protein which is most bioavailable to the human body, the one we process the most efficiently, comes from animal-based product, not from plant-based. Soy, pea protein, absolutely, you know, they do contain proteins. They don't, however, contain a complete amount, and they're certainly not bioavailable to the extent that comes from meat. So is there an upper limit? Well, it's probably 100 grams of protein per day for the average 80 kilo person, 80 to 100 kilo. And which that means they probably can have a couple of 100 grams of red meat.
That sounds good to me. Now, let's take a short break now to hear a message from our podcast partner, Elanco Animal Health.
This podcast is brought to you by CompuDose, a proven way to maximise growth rates in grass-fed cattle. CompuDose allows you to target and achieve specifications for most major markets, including MSA grading and feedlots. Contact Elanco and find out how CompuDose can grow your beef operation. Results may vary depending on nutrition. Always read and follow label directions.
You're on The Grill with Beef Central. I'm Kerry Lonergan, and our guest today on The Grill is Dr. Gary Fetke, a doctor with a difference and a great story. Look, it's been also suggested that how you cook your meat is as important as what's actually in the meat. So are barbecues still on the agenda? Or are they allowed?
I think if you're going to make something a black charcoal steak, then I'm not going to condone that. But again, the literature is somewhat confusing in that area, and it is thought that some of those burnt byproducts of burning meat may in fact be carcinogenic. However, I'm not having a barbecue every day. The barbecue steak to me is not my my daily intake. Again, we're in Tasmania, so most of the time I'll cook it in a fry pan inside where I've got a little bit more control over the temperature. And so having your barbecue and not having every meal of your day cooked on the barbecue, I think, is perfectly fine.
What about slow cooking, Gary? That's boomed in recent years. It's now a multi-billion dollar business. Is that the way to go, slow cooking your meat?
Well, the advantage of slow cooking is that those less tender pieces of meat or cups of meat can actually be cooked. And so therefore, I think, A, welcome it. B, you're certainly not going to get all those, those charred remnants on it. And it's utilising the full animal in a productive way. And I think that's the other thing is we should be utilising the whole animal and not throwing things away.
Doctors, I've heard, suggest that we actually consume much more protein than we need. Do you see that in our most common diet these days? Too much protein, perhaps?
I think that's been demonised. However, when you actually look at it, most times when people, the comparative analysis is that they, at the same time as it's being accused of having too much protein, they're missing out on the fact that they're having that often with French fries and chips and excessive carbohydrate and high doses of sugar. When you some of those, I just saw a paper yesterday which looked at demonising red meat, but the people were eating hot dogs, chips and sugar-sweetened beverages, and those refined carbohydrates, the sugars and the polyunsaturated oils, I think at a biochemical level, infinitely worse than the protein that's actually in meat.
Now, you have a rather intriguing theory. We've broadly touched on this earlier. An intriguing theory on when and why the anti-meat campaign started?
I don't think it's a theory because it's been acknowledged by the people that we've actually brought to the fore. If we have an anti-meat message, we've got to work out where it's come from. And there are lots of people that now get on board with that anti-meat message, the whole vegan movement, the vegetarian movement to some degree. But the Western vegetarian, Western vegan concept actually stems back to temperance movement in the 1860s, and in particular the influence of the Seventh-day Adventist Church and their prophetess Ellen G. White. So everything I'm about to say has actually been acknowledged by them in an article in 2018, a journal called Religion, and senior members of the church have written in it, and in the references actually acknowledge the work that my wife and has done in this process. So literally, the Seventh-day Adventist Church is behind the majority of the vegan influence that we now see today. And Ellen G. White, who was their prophetess, incredibly the most prolific woman in the Western literature, Her works have been published over and over and over. And she was the origin of meat causes cancer, meat causes violence, meat causes disease, and there's a founding belief in that meat causes masturbation. Now, where that flows on to where we are now is that her first book, which was essentially a message to mothers about meat causes masturbation, and therefore that's the vilest sin, that was typeset by a 12-year-old by the name of John Harvey Kellogg. So John Harvey Kellogg was brainwashed at the age of 12. He then spent the rest of his life under that influence and that church belief. He invented breakfast cereal, and the breakfast cereal of today was invented on the purpose of quelling our sinful thoughts, our lustful thoughts. And a lot of people can't believe this, but when you actually look up John Harvey Kellogg, look up cereal and masturbation, you'll see the whole thing just unfolds. So what's fascinating about that is the Seventh-day Adventist Church, 101 cereal companies were started in a place called Battle Creek, Michigan in the US, virtually all of them owned by the cereal industry. And where they are nowadays is you've effectively got people go, who are the Seventh-day Adventist Church? Well, in fact, they're the second biggest educator in the world after the Catholic Church, number one. Influencing the minds, particularly in the developing world, they effectively influence about a fifth to a quarter of the US medical system. They effectively own the cereal industry of the world, the soy industry of the world. The fake meat industry of the world was started by John Harvey Kellogg's. The meat analogs all started. And as a result of that, they've got incredible influence, incredible lobbying power, and they were the ones that started the textbooks on nutrition. And that message, right through influencing vegetarian guidelines, the acceptance of veganism, vegetarianism, into food dietary guidelines, it's all there. And they've been behind it right from the outset. And then other industries have then flowed on with it. And where they are in Australia, they're called Sanitarium. Sanitarium Health and Wellbeing sounds fabulous. Australia's most trusted company because they say so. But when you start looking at some of their subsidiary companies, you start to realise that their subsidiary companies include, you know, just for way of the meat industry, the alternative meat company here in Australia is actually owned by Sanitarium Health and Wellbeing. And when you go to their webpage and you start seeing their anti-meat rhetoric, which is full of falsehoods, then you go, hang on, you know, every farmer, I suggest go to the alternative meat company, see what what they're stating, see how you feel about it, and then actually realise that the parent company of the alternative meat company, the alternative dairy company, is in fact Sanitarium here in Australia.
You've just encouraged Dr. Fetke, a lot of our listeners to read, and including myself, to read more about Mr. Kellogg. We've got time for a couple of quick questions. Does the red meat industry do enough to portray a positive image and combat the negativity we often see?
I think the simple message is no. The meat farmer has a great product. As I say, the animal-based agriculture, it's a complete product, complete proteins, complete healthy fats, complete minerals, complete micronutrients, particularly if you're eating nose to tail. It's good farming practice. It helps the environment. Animals eating grass actually puts carbon dioxide back in the soil. It sequestrates it magnificently. Plant-based agriculture, on the other side, provides incomplete protein, incomplete fats, contains proteins which are like gluten and lectins, which are actually irritant to people and people develop allergies. And micronutrient poor, that energy dense, that associated well and truly with our health and poor outcomes. We're not hearing this message. When you plough land, you create far more environmental damage and erosion as a result of it. I don't hear that message out there at all. All I'm hearing is a message propagated by the processed food industry, in particular demonising red meat. So does the industry do enough? No, you've got a great product, but I think it's now time to get down and get dirty about it. And this mischief has gone on forever. And I know I'm taking pulling a long string on a bow, but in Genesis, Cain and Abel, you know, taking the Bible as a descriptive book, Cain killed Abel in a jealous rage over the offering given to God. Abel was the shepherd who gave the lamb offering, and Cain gave the offering of fruit from the land, which included grain and fruit. And God favoured Abel's offering, and then Cain killed Abel in a jealous rage. This separation of plant-based agricultural practice and animal-based agricultural practice has actually been there for as long as man's been describing how to live. Now, I realise that suits my narrative to bring that up, but it's fascinating that for as long as time, the time immemorial, we've had this separation of plant-based agriculture from animal-based. And currently, particularly in social media and in lobbying groups, the meat sector is losing. And it shouldn't, because it's got the better product.
Dr. Gary Fitke, we've run out of time, I'm afraid. You're an intriguing and a positive presence in the beef industry. More power to you. It's been fascinating having you on the program. Thanks for coming on The Grill.
Pleasure, Gary. Thank you.
And thank you for joining me today. Until next time, I'm Kerry Lonigan, and this is The Weekly Grill, brought to you by Beef Central and our podcast partner, Elanco Animal Health.